Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with yesterday's commemorations of the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and discuss the other missing piece, along with how come none of the killers of 3,000 have been brought to trial, and that is, why has nobody tasked with protecting the United States against attack who failed to act on ample evidence of a clear and present danger have been held to account? Joining us is Philip Sheenan, the best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, a former reporter for The New York Times and Washington Post who covered the Pentagon, Justice Department, and State Department. We will discuss the bipartisan inquiry into 9/11, which deliberately did not seek to blame, but also left many questions unanswered, leaving room for conspiracy theories to flourish. Then we'll look into comparisons between Al-Qaeda and ISIS terrorism and the far-right domestic terrorists in the United States who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th. Suzanne Schneider, the Deputy Director and Core Faculty at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, joins us to discuss the uncanny overlap between jihadist groups and far-right reactionary movements in the West, which she charts in her new book, just out, The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism. And we will also discuss her article at Foreign Policy Magazine, Failed Governance Has Created Extremists in the United States Too. The Islamic State and the U.S. far right share the same roots. Then finally, we will speak with Jeff Thiel, the former president of the Washington Office on Latin America, where he oversaw their work on Central America, focusing on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. He joins us to discuss the increasingly authoritarian and popular young leader in El Salvador, who has turned El Salvador into the first country to make Bitcoin the national currency, which will likely lead to El Salvador becoming the money laundering capital of the world. And before we go to our first guest, now that I have resigned in protest from Pacifica and its Los Angeles station KPFK, we have moved fully to online broadcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where we will be depending upon you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so that those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Philip Sheenan, who is a best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. And his latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Sheenan.
Thanks, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Thursday, I interviewed Kristen Breitweiser, who's one of the 9/11 widows, who's been very active. And she still has not got justice for the killers of her husband. The killers of her husband and 3,000 others have not been brought to justice. But equally true, surely, Phil, is the fact that nobody on the American side has been brought to justice for negligence and ignoring the warnings, etc. I mean, you wrote about the 9/11 Commission just as nobody in terms of those who attacked us on 9/11 have been brought to justice. Nobody that missed the warning signs or acted in any negligent way has been brought to justice. And the commission that you covered and wrote about did not do that, did it?
It decided from the get-go it wasn't going to do it. You know, this really, the 9/11 Commission was an investigation without any personal accountability at all. You know, there are a lot of people who you could single out for blame for the blunders that allowed 9/11 to happen. And not one of those people was disciplined or prosecuted. And in fact, after 9/11, a lot of them got promoted, got better jobs as a result of this. And I think I can certainly understand the frustration for the 9/11 families, because there clearly were people to blame for what had happened, and not one of them was ever held to account.
Well, the CIA director at the time, George Tenet, and his counterterrorism chief, Richard Clark, they issued several warnings to the National Security Council and Condoleezza Rice. First of all, there was a memo on January the 25th of 2001 requesting an urgent National Security Council meeting because of their fears about Al-Qaeda threat, and they actually had a plan how to deal with it. The meeting was never finally, it only happened in April of 2001, and they weren't, the Bush National Security team were not interested in what Clark and others had to say. They wanted to focus on Iraqi terrorism. And then in May, the CIA again warned that Al-Qaeda is working inside the United States plotting attacks. On May the 1st, the CIA Daily Brief warned that the group is presently in the United States and preparing to attack. And there was another warning came on June the 22nd, and then another CIA warning came in the Daily Brief on June the 29th, which was really specific, and that was when Bush sort of finished the meeting, George W. Bush finished the meeting by saying, well, you guys have covered your ass. And then, of course, August the 6th was the famous presidential daily briefing titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S. So the record's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, Phil?
You know, one of the great contributions of both the 9/11 Commission and the congressional investigation was that it very clearly made out the narrative of what happened that summer, the summer before 9/11. And the story was that, you know, the famous line, the system was blinking red. It really was blinking red. The White House was being flooded with information suggesting that a terrorist attack was about to happen and that it could involve hijacked airplanes and it could involve the city of New York. And it sure appeared at the end of the investigations that it was established that the George Bush White House, and in particular Condoleezza Rice, she has a lot of explaining to do here, that they really just brushed aside all of these warnings and their claims after the attacks that this couldn't have been prevented, that there was no actionable intelligence. That is clearly not true. And as I say, we never got the accountability we were looking for out of these investigations, but we sure have a very clear documentary trail of just how often the Bush White House was warned that something was about to happen and just how often the Bush White House brushed aside these concerns.
And in a total of actually 36 times that the CIA warned the Bush White House. And of course, this has led to conspiracy theories that somehow Condoleezza Rice and others wanted this to happen to rescue Bush and Cheney's failing presidency. Of course, that's totally absurd. But what does explain Condoleezza Rice's lack of attention to this flashing red light?
Well, again, just from what we now know of the documentary record, Condoleezza Rice, who's really a key figure, she's the national security advisor to George Bush. George Bush, who's new to his job, doesn't have a lot of experience in national security issues. She is really the key figure in his life to explain to him what the global threats are. And it sure appears from the documentary record that she just couldn't get very interested in terrorism. She was much more interested in sort of big powers issues. She was much more interested in the threat from the Russians or the threat from Iran or the threat from North Korea. You'll recall the infamous Axis of Evil, that they were focused on those nations, not on this sort of amorphous threat from a terrorist group they didn't understand. And as they, to the credit of the CIA and the FBI and other agencies, they were warning the White House over and over again to do something, to get together, to organize, to deal with these threats. But Condoleezza Rice just wasn't focused on the issue.
And again, I'm speaking with Philip Sheenan, who's a best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and a former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries and several war zones. And his latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. So, Phil, yesterday, George W. Bush, former president, made what most people consider to be a very moving speech at the site of the plane that was taken down by the bravery of the passengers aboard. The plane was on its way to crash into the Capitol, and that would have, of course, been a massive disaster. One of the planes, of course, was supposed to hit the White House, which then turned around and went back and hit the South Tower at the World Trade Center. But still, the possibility of those attacks succeeding would have made this, I think, the national trauma so much greater. But yesterday at the site in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, President Bush said, "There is growing evidence that the dangers to our country can come not only across borders, but from violence that gathers within. There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home. But in their disdain for pluralism and their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit. And it is our continuing duty to confront them." What do you make of that? It's almost like a dig at the people who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th.
I certainly think it was meant to be read that way. And I think there are people who are close to Donald Trump who were unhappy with that speech because it seemed to be a dig at him as well. But no, it's interesting that Bush finally stepped forward and offered, you know, it wasn't direct criticism of what had happened on January 6th, but it was, I think, useful to have it established that this former Republican president is as disgusted as so many other Americans are about what happened on January 6th, and that it should be viewed as a form of terrorism.
Well, speaking of the former President Trump, one of the things I find extraordinary about 9/11 was that on that very day, Trump was on local New York television just after the towers had come down, boasting that he now had the tallest building in Wall Street. I mean, talk about insensitive. It was just sort of psychopathic.
It was just hugely callous. And it was funny, too, because typical of Trump, it was also wrong because he didn't have the second tallest building in New York City. So he managed both to be callous and incorrect all at the same time. And it's not the only whopper he told about 9/11. You'll recall he also claimed to have gone to the site, to Ground Zero, to help in the search for survivors. And I don't think there's any evidence anywhere to suggest that's true.
Well, of course, for some reason or other, Rudy Giuliani became a hero now because he's pretty tarnished. But what exactly did he do that made him into a hero?
Well, in my book about the 9/11 Commission, he's a key character because he was a big focus of attention for the commission. And he was quite scary for the commission at the time because he was arguably the most popular politician in America at that point. People thought of him as the next president of the United States because of what people saw as his great heroism on 9/11. And you recall that he is seen on the streets of the city leading crowds away from Ground Zero and speaking rather eloquently and bravely about the what the nation faced in the war on terrorism at a time when George Bush had gone missing. You recall that he's taken away by Air Force One and nobody's quite sure where he is. So Rudy Giuliani in those hours was sort of seen as the national leader. It turned out, of course, that the reason he was on the street was because of his failures as a mayor of New York City, that he had, despite lots of warnings that he shouldn't do it, he had put the emergency command center for New York City in a building right near 9/11. He was told not to do it because the World Trade Center was seen as a terrorist threat, and you don't want to have your emergency command center near what may well be a target of terrorism. But Giuliani insisted on it. 9/11 happened. Immediately, the emergency command center is not available to him, so he has to go to the street. And in going to the street, he becomes a hero. So his great failure turns him into a national hero for a time.
Well, he was also very close to the New York field office of the FBI. And the head of that field office, O'Neill, was one of the very few, along with Frank Pellegrino, who had been FBI agent who had been tracking Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. O'Neill had been warning the FBI, and Louis Freeh just gave him the back of his hand, didn't he?
You know, Louis Freeh, the FBI director, you know, the smartest thing he ever did was to leave the FBI shortly before 9/11. which meant he was sort of out of the line of fire when people were trying to hold government officials accountable for 9/11. Now, Louis Freeh, his mismanagement of the FBI on terrorism explains a lot of what went wrong at the FBI ahead of 9/11. But as I say, by the time 9/11 happened, he had just left office, and it was people were looking to new leadership at the FBI, a guy by the name of Robert Mueller. And Mueller was the guy who had to account for what the FBI had done right and done wrong before 9/11.
And O'Neill, didn't he get a job after he left the FBI in disgust because he couldn't get Freeh and others to take him seriously when he kept warning about the Al-Qaeda threat? Didn't he then take on the job as head of security at the World Trade Center and died on 9/11?
Exactly. That's how he died. He died at the scene. He was a very controversial figure at the FBI, but clearly he was one of the few within the Bureau, certainly in the New York field office, who really understood the terrorist threat, wanted the FBI to react more aggressively to it, and sort of hit a brick wall with Louis Freeh and others at FBI in Washington.
And then the FBI in Minnesota, of course, missed the warnings from some of the local agents there who had warned about these characters like Zacharias, who was arrested before 9/11, learning how to fly jumbo jets but not learning how to land them.
I mean, the whole story of the FBI in the run-up to 9/11 is one of failure after failure after failure. I remember that Tom Kane, who was the head of the 9/11 Commission, I remember a quotation from him that, you know, the FBI failed and it failed and it failed and it failed. And there are several instances of this. There was this gentleman arrested in Minneapolis just a few weeks before 9/11 who, as you say, was seeking to learn quickly how to fly jumbo jets. The Minneapolis field office thought this guy was a terrorist who wanted to hijack a plane and use it as some sort of weapon. But they just couldn't get Washington headquarters of the FBI to pay any attention to this figure. And as a result, Moussaoui's laptop was never searched. If they'd gone through his laptop, it might have turned up evidence to suggest the 9/11 plot. There was another field agent in Phoenix who urged in the months before 9/11 that the FBI conducted a nationwide survey of young Arab men seeking flight training in the U.S. because he thought there was some possibility that there were lots of young Arab men seeking flight training who intended to use that training for terrorism. But again, he too faced a brick wall in Washington and couldn't get any approval for this nationwide survey.
So, but again, Phil Sheenan, the fact that you have this litany of mistakes from the FBI has led to these conspiracy theories. You can see, in a way, you can see why. But life is obviously more complicated than the way that conspiracy theorists try to tie everything up with a neat bow. And, of course, the idea that somehow the buildings were mined with explosive charges, which, you know, would require thousands and thousands of packages of C4 along with thousands and thousands of miles of debt cord in a building fully occupied, and somehow nobody noticed that. And furthermore, if you could even mine the buildings to demolish them, why would the planes then fly into the buildings? The whole thing is so bizarre. But is there a connection between the perpetuation of conspiracy theories and the lack of accounting? In other words, had the 9/11 Commission done a thorough job and named names and told us the whole sorry story, maybe people wouldn't be indulging in these ridiculous conspiracy theories.
Well, I kind of feared that in this day and age, they probably would be indulging in conspiracy theories regardless of what you do. But I think people, certainly the 9/11 families would feel they could put to rest some of their own conspiracy theories, certainly about sort of government malfeasance, if they knew that certain people had been held to account. I do wonder if a 9/11 event happened today. I fear that social media being what it is, the conspiracy theories would begin to spin within minutes, and I just don't know how you'd ever be able to control them.
Right. Well, what did you take away since you studied the commission and the two heads of the commission, both Governor Keene and Congressman Lee Hamilton, was at the Wilson Center in Washington this week talking about it and basically celebrating the bipartisan nature of the commission? And of course, we know now that there's absolutely zero bipartisanship in Washington. I'm not sure celebrating bipartisanship, given that they came up pretty empty and nobody was held to account. But what's your feeling in the last minutes here?
I probably have a more nuanced view of them. I too felt great frustration, as I know the families did, with the lack of accountability. I think Kane and Hamilton may have something of a point in their argument that if they had engaged in true accountability, if there had been real finger pointing, the investigation might well have broken down into a partisan mess. They thought the only way to get around that was to try to establish the narrative of how agencies had failed, and to present that narrative in their final report and to get unanimity about it. And they were able to accomplish that. And I will say, I am impressed that sort of the big recommendation of the 9/11 Commission was the creation of the Office of Director of National Intelligence, the DNI. And I think that office has actually proved more effective than a lot of us thought it would be at the beginning. And I think during the Trump administration in particular, the occupant of that office actually performed a very valuable service of keeping an independent check on what may have been real wrongdoing going on elsewhere in the intelligence community. So I'm very critical of the 9/11 Commission for its failures of accountability. But at the end of the day, Kane and Hamilton can point to some accomplishments.
Right, but the first director of national intelligence that Trump had was the one, the senator from Indiana, who held the line. But after that, of course, Trump put in political hacks and toadies.
That's absolutely true. But Dan Coats was there for a good long while. Sure. And as I say, I think we now know that he performed a very important service to the country behind the scenes in keeping a check on what was, I think, probably pretty terrible stuff going on elsewhere in the intelligence community. He did leave, you're correct, and he was replaced by hacks. But for the period of time he was there, that office proved to be very valuable in, I think, protecting the country.
Well, Philip Sheehan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Sheehan, who's a best-selling author of The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation, and the former reporter for The New York Times for more than 20 years. As a Washington correspondent for The New York Times, he covered the Pentagon, the Justice Department, and the State Department. And as a foreign correspondent, he reported from more than 60 countries in several war zones. And his latest book is A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. We can take a brief station break and be back with a look into comparisons between Al-Qaeda and ISIS terrorism and the far-right domestic terrorists in the United States who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th.
Did you see the frightened ones? Did you hear the falling bombs? Did you ever wonder why we had to run for shelter when the promise of a brave new world unfurled beneath the clear blue sky?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Suzanne Schneider, who is the Deputy Director of the Core Faculty at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, specializing in political theory and the history of the modern Middle East. She's the author of Mandatory Separation, Religion, Education, and Mass Politics in Palestine, and her new book just out, The Apocalypse and the End of History, Mod Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism. And she has an article on foreign policy. Failed governance has created extremists in the United States, too. The Islamic State and the U.S. far right share the same roots. Welcome to Background Briefing, Suzanne Schneider.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it's almost as though former President George W. Bush read your article in Foreign Policy, because on Saturday, on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, at the site of where the plane crashed in Pennsylvania, the one that was heading for the Capitol, George W. Bush said, "There's growing evidence that the dangers to our country can come not from only across borders, but from violence that gathers within. There is little cultural overlap between violent extremists abroad and violent extremists at home. But in their disdain for pluralism, in their disregard for human life, in their determination to defile national symbols, they are children of the same foul spirit, and it is our continuing duty to confront them." How did it strike you, Suzanne?
So these, you know, comparisons, I think, have been trotted out with increased frequency since the attacks on January 6th. And there is something to them, but usually not what those making them think. Right. And I come at this from a slightly different angle, not really as a specialist in American politics so much as a specialist in Islamist movements and history of the modern Middle East. And I've been working on this book for about the Islamic State for about 7 years now, and had been kind of noticing these really uncanny points of overlap between the way in which it positioned itself, the way that it made effective appeals to, recruits, and talked about the kind of role of individuals, the kind of fetishization of a golden age that never was, you know, so on and so forth. So I think that there is something to hear. I actually do think there's quite a bit of overlap, I don't know if we want to call it cultural overlap or not, but I would tend to think so, than between these two entities, merely because one of them is kind of mobilizing through the language of Islam and one is mobilizing through the language of Christian nationalism, doesn't mean that they don't have cultural overlap. But what you really learn, I think, from studying these groups in the Middle East, in North Africa, and Central Asia in context, points to some pretty important lessons, right? That they have something in common with the American far right, but not what is commonly thought. And these kind of jihadi groups in the region are first and foremost a symptom of a widespread legitimacy crisis in many Muslim majority countries that had a kind of historical arc in over the 20th century from a colony to a post-colonial state that would initially seem to hold out so much revolutionary promise and then kind of quickly descended into various forms of authoritarian governance. And it is in these contexts, in the kind of the colony and the post-colony, where I think the state apparatus was most honed as a vehicle for serving elite interests. And that to the extent that the government was ever present in your life, it was never present in a positive way, but really as a kind of wielder of violence. And the real hollowing out of the state to this entity that essentially advanced kind of elite interests on the one hand, and prevented popular mobilizations against that accord on the other. So I would like people, if they're going to make these comparisons between kind of extremist groups in the Middle East, for instance, and those on the kind of closer to home here on the American far right, I would want to encourage people to think about, well, then what is it exactly about the kind of present moment or the last several decades that has been so generative of these reactionary movements? And I think here, too, we are facing a kind of legitimacy crisis of epic proportions. And that is a crisis that does not go away through violence. It doesn't go away through more state violence. We've seen this kind of, abroad in the, global war on terror. I think that is the kind of abiding lesson, is one that we cannot achieve the security we want through repressive force alone. And so I'm kind of wary then, when these comparisons are trotted out and seem to support a call for some sort of domestic counterpoint to the global war on terror that's going to be targeted at these actors, internally. It's not that people shouldn't be prosecuted and rooted out, but that more state violence is unlikely to quell the legitimation crisis, which is, in my analysis, where these groups actually come from.
Well, it does seem that it's a crisis of legitimacy of government that spurs this movement and the breakdown of politics as usual, as you point out. But, for example, it seems that in terms of the Islamic State in the Middle East, there's a rejection of modernism. It seems in many ways that the far right, particularly the religious right, the people in Texas, for example, behind this new attack on abortion rights, in fact, the new radical Republican Party seems to be populated by largely white people who kind of want to opt out of the United States. They don't like the way the United States is heading. They don't like pluralism and multiculturalism. And it's almost like they want to create their own caliphate as well.
So the thing is, though, as much as these groups, both, right, whether we're talking about the Taliban, whether we're talking about kind of Texas, as much as these groups might seem like they are some sort of like holdouts from medieval times or an attempt to kind of return to this like less enlightened era, I don't believe that that's the case. I think they are actually hyper modern. And that they're, and in even groups that kind of claim to be traditional, like that is a telltale sign of their modernity. No one who's really quote unquote traditional walks around claiming that as a kind of label. You know, you mentioned the, you know, kind of also like the example of the Islamic State, which I just, you know, completed this book as a kind of close case study of the various ways in which they are hyper-modern, not just modern, but hyper-modern, how they lean very heavily on a liberal ideal of the individual as the central social and political actor that is able to kind of act outside of the kind of framework of a traditional state. That's not a 19th century idea. That's not a, certainly not a 13th century idea or a 7th century idea. It's a very 20th century idea and a particularly neoliberal idea at that. Right, they advance a vision of identity that's both global and digitally mediated, that looks a lot more like an online fan club than a kind of traditional, you know, either imperial or national identity that is grounded by territory, right? It's like identity that doesn't need territory anymore. Again, you don't have a kind of correlate for that in some sort of kind of earlier, you know, time. Even the way that they deploy violence almost exclusively as a kind of mechanism of spectacle. Sometimes really apart from any sort of, you know, strategic end is something that is built for a world with, you know, globalized media, with 24/7 kind of cable news, with social networks that are enable people to kind of view and share and disseminate, you know, clips or messages, you know, quite rapidly. Arguably, this facilitates a new type of violence, you know, and even something that we associate with Islamic terrorism, something like suicide bombing, right? This is not a thing. This is not a longstanding piece of Islamic life. In, you know, you have the first suicide bombs really in the early 80s in the context of the occupation of Beirut. This is something which has been happening for no more than 40 years that gets absorbed ideologically and then cast back into the past as something that is deeply rooted. And so those claims are constantly being trotted out, right? That we are doing nothing other than returning to kind of the ways of the pious forefathers. But if we scratch beneath the surface, we see that it is, these movements are incredibly innovative, that they are, you know, that there is nothing quote unquote traditional about them. And that rather than being something that is opposed to our modernity, which I think in some ways would be easier for us to accommodate, they are somehow a crisis of our modernity, that they come from within the same system that we all live within. So we can't just get rid of them or kind of make sense of them by saying that they are something else. They are something other. They come from a different world. They're either the Islamic world or the medieval world. I think the much more troubling task for us as like political and social commentators is understanding how they are actually a product of a world that we live into.
And again, I'm speaking with Suzanne Schneider, who is the Deputy Director and Core Faculty at the Brookings Institute for Social Research, specializing in political theory and history of the modern Middle East. She's the author of Mandatory Separation, Religion, Education, and Mass Politics in Palestine, and her new book just out, The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism. And she has an article in Foreign Policy, Failed Governance Has Created Extremists in the United States Too, the Islamic State and the U.S. far right share the same roots. So the prescription is, in both cases, better governance. And you point out in your article as well that the Islamic State, when they did take over areas of Iraq and Syria, actually did pick up the garbage and had better government. So how then do we reinstate? I guess it comes down to the notion of social democracy. I mean, arguably, we had a social democracy in the United States between 1944 and 1977. Yeah. The Europeans have it, too. People in those countries tend to vote for politicians who provide social services and recycle their tax money in useful and responsible ways that help the community, not the super rich, as the case here is in the United States. So how do we basically bring forth that message, because that is the solution, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I do believe that the solution is a rebuilding of state capacity. You know, people often talk about this last 40 years or so, right, since the late 70s, as this period of neoliberalism. And this is kind of like, sounds like one of these big academic words, but it really, you know, it's useful to kind of demarcate this period from kind of what came beforehand. And neoliberalism is sometimes spoken about as a kind of reduction in the state, right? The state kind of pulling back from crucial areas, right? The embrace of small governments. We have the famous Ronald Reagan line that I kind of quote in the foreign policy piece, right? The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." And we can now at this vantage point see that whole kind of attack on government as being, on the one hand, kind of very ideologically motivated from a conservative and very wealthy in particular base, intent on attacking whatever minimal kind of social safety network the United States had. And on the other hand, we could see that it's not really a small government agenda. It's not that the government shrinks. It's that the government kind of pulls back in certain areas and then goes roaring forward in others. So government might pull back from things like welfare. The government might pull back from education or infrastructure spending or environmental regulation. It certainly does not pull back, though, from violence. And I would like people to think about those as related phenomena, that as state capacity is reduced and the state can no longer intervene in positive ways in people's lives, it does have to rely more and more on force and the kind of coercive mechanisms of the state, policing, mass incarceration at home, kind of militarism and kind of our new imperialism abroad, right, to prop up this social order. And so that these are related phenomena. So it's not that the state shrinks, that the state is captured and redeployed. So yes.
Well, the only thing that we have in this divided government and this highly polarized political environment in this country that Democrats and Republicans agree on is throwing more money at the Pentagon. And essentially what we're doing is we're refining the quality of death at the expense of the quality of life.
Absolutely a really key point that this has been largely a bipartisan project that has, and again, it's the same story or just different versions of the story, whether we're looking kind of domestically or whether we're looking abroad through the kind of global war on terror framework, is that it is the attempt of security through force. Security through state violence, that a kind of a framework and an operational worldview that posits that more state violence is always going to be the answer to whatever political or social crisis we are facing. And I just think that this approach is really bankrupt. We've seen the various ways in which it is bankrupt abroad. And I would want people to really kind of take those lessons before we think that we need to, enact some sort of, domestic war on terror to amplify the already extremely repressive capabilities of the American state.
So in terms of what happened on January the 6th and whether or not there'll be any sort of justice in the sense that we've already seen how the right-wing media and Trump, who controls the Republican Party, have tried to rewrite history and turn these criminals, the thugs, and this mishmash of people that you described in an earlier article in the Washington Post, the Trump mob was both menacing and ridiculous, dangerous and utterly delusional. But in terms of changing the narrative back to what we actually saw, you mentioned in your piece in Foreign Policy that Elizabeth Newman, the former Assistant Secretary of Counterterrorism and Threat Prevention at the United States Department of Homeland Security, had suggested that it doesn't make any sense to me that why, if you commit a crime in the name of white supremacy or you commit a crime in the name of ISIS ideology, you get more jail time for ISIS versus the Violent White Supremacist Act. What do you think should be done in terms of justice coming out of January the 6th? So far, we haven't seen much of it.
Yeah, I mean, but the fact that we haven't seen much of it also, doesn't have to, I don't think that it has to do with an inadequate number of laws on the books that, that we could use to kind of prosecute people. Right. I'm not a lawyer, so I do lean on kind of, the findings of, those who are, in the piece, I quote people from NYU, from the law school there, kind of really disputing this logic that we don't have, the sufficient means already to go after, these insurrectionists. The bigger issue, I think, has been historically, at least, one of reticence on behalf of law enforcement to prosecute those who are, you know, yeah, who are white supremacists, who are fascists, who are kind of, you know, advancing this type of agenda, because those things have traditionally not been viewed as ideological. And this is a, and this gets to something really about the kind of post 9/11, you know, US, the world that we live in, kind of in a post 9/11 period, in which terrorism, you know, was formally defined by the American government as something that comes from without, perpetrated by non-state actors, you know, and very much associated not just with Muslims, but specifically with, right, those on the outside, or their kind of, you know, sleeper cells on the inside. And within that framing, you know, Islamism or jihadism, all of these things, these are ideologies, but white supremacy is not recognized as an ideology. And I think that's because it's so baked into the pie of this country, right, that it's just the status quo. It's taken for granted. So I think that the again, like, the solution to that, though, is not necessarily like a domestic terrorism statute, which I do believe will be counterproductive and will soon be kind of turned on people of color and leftists. I like feel like that's almost the inevitable result of that. But to actually choose to prosecute people who were engaged in this insurrection, people who called for this insurrection, using the very robust, you know, criminal code that's already at our disposal.
Well, Suzanne Snyder, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, you're welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Suzanne Snyder, who's the Deputy Director and Core Faculty at the Brookings Institute for Social Research, specializing in political theory and history of the modern Middle East. She's the author of Mandatory Separation, Religion, Education, and Mass Politics in Palestine. And her new book just out is The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism. And she has an article on foreign policy. Failed governance has created extremists in the United States, too. The Islamic State and the U.S. far right share the same roots. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the increasingly authoritarian and popular young leader in El Salvador, who has turned El Salvador into the first country to make Bitcoin the national currency, which will likely lead to El Salvador becoming the money laundering capital of the world. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeff Thale, the former president of the Washington Office on Latin America, where he oversaw their work on Central America, focusing on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in the region, with a particular emphasis on Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Thale.
Hi. Great to be with you again. Thanks.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jeff. And we covered Nicaragua the other day, which is pretty grim, with the Ortega Murillo husband and wife dictatorship jailing all credible opposition leaders with absolute brutality. And apparently, according to human rights observers, the Ortega Murillo government is even worse than the Somoza government that Sandinistas overthrew in terms of their brutality towards their citizens. So it's a grim picture.
Sure. So Sergio Ramirez, who was the first vice president of the Sandinistas under Daniel Ortega, there was an arrest order put out against him yesterday, I believe, and he tweeted yesterday afternoon, the last time there had been an arrest order put out against him, it was put out in 1977, and it was put out by the Somoza dictatorship. And here is the Ortega Murillo government doing exactly the same thing. So it's an ugly full circle, and it's really a tragic situation.
But the situation in El Salvador, neither get a lot of attention, I might add, but the situation in El Salvador I find quite alarming. I've been sort of watching this Bukele, this young leader who's very popular, but he has all of the sort of trappings of a kind of young fascist, and he's behaving in incredibly authoritarian ways, and he's instituted Bitcoin as the nation's currency, and it has not worked out very well for him. But that doesn't
right.
Disguise the fact that this young popular leader is dismantling democracy in El Salvador.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, Bukele ran as a sort of young, hip, forward-thinking, outside the traditional parties kind of guy. He won a lot of support. He's quite a Twitter expert. He won the presidency overwhelmingly, and then he won a majority for his party in the National Assembly overwhelmingly. And you've seen kind of the progressive unraveling of democratic institutions ever since. They're discussing a new constitution that would permit him repeated terms in office. The new assembly on its first day in office this spring named new members to the Supreme Court and a new attorney general. The new Supreme Court ruled that the president's reelection is a constitutional right just the other day. The new National Assembly just passed a law ordering all judges and attorney people in the Attorney General's office over the age of 60 to retire, so that the new court will now be able to nominate new judges and attorneys. So it's really a matter of progressively consolidating political power under his own kind of personal and family control, and it's really pretty deeply troubling. He just this week, the El Salvador just this week finally accepted Bitcoin as legal tender, and that's a huge risk. Like anybody, we all know people who've invested in Bitcoin and made money. So, you know, maybe he'll make money, maybe the country will make money off this, but it's a huge risk. It's not tied to any fixed currency. It could lose value. If you look at El Salvador's bonds, which are a measure of what other people think of their risk, they've been losing value steadily for the last few weeks. And because it's a completely unregulated system, I mean, people who love Bitcoin love it because it's a free market, unregulated system. And like a lot of free market banking systems, it runs the risk of corruption, of collapse, of sort of all kinds of disasters. So President Bukele is taking a tremendous risk with his government's economy and with the well-being of his people by doing this, and doing it particularly in the way he's doing it.
Well, according to the Central American Institute for Fiscal Studies, they believe that El Salvador is about to become a money laundering paradise because of Bitcoin.
Well, I think that's one of the dangers, right? Bitcoin is clearly a way for people to put money made through whatever way, all sorts of illicit ways, into circulation, but outside the traditional banking system with all its regulations. So if you earn more than $10,000 or deposit more than $10,000 in a bank in the United States, you have to register it, and the IRS and all sorts of people will take a look at that. If you buy Bitcoin with that money, no one will know, no one will ask. And in that way, that's sort of what the dark economy is all about. And Bitcoin is a facilitator of that. And El Salvador, by becoming the first country in the world to adopt Bitcoin as legal currency, is likely, I think, ISEFI, the Institute for Central American Studies, Economic Studies, is right that they run a huge risk of serving as a place where all sorts of criminal enterprises can launder their money.
Well, he's attacking democracy all over the place, Bukele, and he's particularly gone after the news organization in El Salvador, El Faro, the Lighthouse.
Right.
And he's jailed their leaders, and I think some of them have fled. He's actually charged them with the money laundering in a trumped-up charge, right?
Right. So, this is along with trying to formally consolidate all kinds of institutions under his control. He's clearly trying to undermine all opposition. He's especially gone after journalists, and within that, especially after El Faro, which is really a kind of crusading investigative journalism outlet that has really pursued him and his difficulties. He's charged them with evading banking regulations, a little bit ironic since he's now setting up a banking system with no regulation, but he's charged with evading bank regulations and therefore with money laundering. These are clearly sort of specious charges, and they're pretty minor. They're about pretty minor issues, but it's a way to try and shut down his opposition. And he's done that to El Faro. Yeah, a number of the key people in Alfaro are out of the country because they're at risk of being arrested. He's done that with other journalists. Just today, I believe, a center-right think tank originally set up in the 1980s with support from USAID was charged with money laundering on the same kinds of grounds because they, too, from the right, maybe not from the left, but from the right, have been critics of Bukele. So, yeah, he's after his opponents every place in addition to consolidating the institutions under his control. It's pretty deeply troubling.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Thale, who's the former president of the Washington Office on Latin America. We oversaw their work on Central America, focusing on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in the region, with a particular emphasis on Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. So the U.S. ambassador there in El Salvador has been pretty vocal, suggesting that Bukele is sort of like a Chavez, you know, in the sense that Chavez was incredibly popular, was elected, and then basically got rid of all the democratic opposition. And, you know, he was a left-wing populist. I don't know, is this guy, Bukele, a right-wing populist? What are his politics, well, apart from the absolute pursuit of power?
Right, that's a really good point. I mean, a couple things to say quickly. One, yeah, I think the U.S. ambassador has been very outspoken about this in recent weeks, and I think that's a good thing. We'll see what kind of measures the U.S. takes to kind of follow up. And, you know, obviously we shouldn't be telling El Salvador or anybody else what to do, but I think we should be concerned about undercutting democratic institutions, and especially one where, you know, 20 to 25% of its population are now people living in the United States and sending remittance money back and, you know, floating the economy. So I think we should be concerned about that. The whatever you think of Chavez, Chavez is clearly on the left, and Bukele is pretty clear that he is not. He's tried very hard to portray himself as sort of post the partisanship of the left and the right. But that said, Bukele has a circle of family and close advisors, all of whom have business and economic interests, and those are, you know, much more market oriented, if that's the word, business interests. They're certainly not, you know, Bukele is certainly not about nationalizing the economy or anything like that. So I think he is, I don't know if I would exactly I'm not sure I would characterize him as a free market type, but he is, yeah, he's in favor of the market economy and clearly in favor of his own sort of friends and allies within that economy. And while parts of the business community were close to the traditional right and opposed Bukele, other parts have certainly gone along with him as well as profitable for them to do so. So
what are these deals that he's made with the gangs that have enormous influence in El Salvador, the MS-13 and 18th Street?
Yeah, so, you know, MS-13 and 18th Street are both gangs, street gangs that really originated in the United States and, in fact, in L.A. 18th Street is in Los Angeles. And they are very powerful in El Salvador. They control a lot of neighborhoods. They recruit young people, mostly but not exclusively men, who don't have a lot of other options in life. They provide identity and income, and they do so often through violence. And, you know, El Salvador, though its homicide rate has gone down, it's still one of the highest in the world. It's 5 or 6 times, maybe, that of the United States right now. So gangs are a real power in the country. And the truth is, every government in the last 15 years has secretly, and every major politician of every political party, has secretly negotiated with gang leaders to try and bring down crime rates, homicide rates especially, in return for different kinds of favors. And President Bukele in his campaign attacked his opponents for doing this. It's pretty clear that, and Alfaro did some of the investigation that showed this, he did some of this kind of secret negotiation with gang leaders while he was mayor of San Salvador. And it's pretty clear that his administration has been doing it recently, and that his director of prisons has been meeting with imprisoned gang leaders and trying to cut deals to bring down the crime rate. Like I said, every government in El Salvador has done this for the last two decades. There's nothing to admire about this, but it's a reality that everybody's done. What's especially stunning about this, I think, is the hypocrisy of Bukele's sort of campaign. I am above this. I am better than this. When he's actually secretly engaged in these kinds of negotiations.
So, Jeff Thaler, you said a little while back that, what, 1/3 of its population of El Salvador is out of the country and sending in remittances. I imagine most of them are in the United States. Is that right?
Yeah, so 20 to 25% of what's of the population of El Salvador is out of the country. The largest single group, that which is 2.5 million people, are in the United States. They're in L.A., they're in Houston. I mean, they're all over the country, but heavy concentrations in the West Coast, especially L.A., in Houston, in New York, here in D.C., where I am. Salvadorans are incredibly hardworking people. They're deeply committed to their country and their family. They send... Ooh, boys, I think the current estimate is about $6 billion a year in remittances back to individuals and family members in El Salvador. And something like 70% of the population of El Salvador receive remittances from somebody abroad, mostly from the United States.
Well, they're going to be nervous about the money they send, the dollars, ending up as Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This is the interesting issue. On the one side, President Bukele has promoted Bitcoin because you can, if you transfer your dollars to Bitcoin and then send them to a relative in El Salvador who has a Bitcoin wallet, which obviously not everybody does, and you have to have a cell phone, and everyone does, and so on. But you can transfer it essentially free. Whereas if you send cash through Western Union, you're going to pay a fee. And so for a lot of people, the attraction of not paying a fee is real, and that's one of the selling points President Bukele has used. So that's an immediate benefit that people see. The flip side of it, though, is you could send $100, and maybe it arrives and it's still $100. Maybe the value has gone up and it's $120 and you're really happy. But maybe the value has gone down because Bitcoin's entirely unregulated and fluctuates wildly. And your $100 is now $80 or $50. So I think people are worried, and it's a big risk.
Well, Bitcoin, it seems to be one of these internet phenomenons. The internet now is so dominated by scams, it's just impossible to navigate. And most of the phone calls I get are scam calls. I don't understand why criminals are allowed to operate so freely in this country. What the hell is the FCC doing about it? But it just seems to be the worst of all worlds, a combination of, the idea that you can bank over the internet. And apart from the fact that it also, Bitcoin consumes massive amounts of electricity, so it's not exactly compatible with the green economy. So everything about it, it just smells to high heaven, and the fact that it can be so easily gamed by money launderers may mean that El Salvador will be the money laundering capital of the world.
Yeah, I think that's a real danger. I mean, I think there's a pretty strong sentiment internationally. I don't want to tell you that I'm a friend of the IM, the International Monetary Fund or anything like that, but I think there is a pretty strong sentiment internationally that cryptocurrencies of all kinds, Bitcoin and all the other things like it, are going to have to be subject to regulation and control. And, without that, that's certainly part of, that's a big part of what led to the Great Depression in the United States. And it's certainly the deregulation, the banking system in the United States contributed to the Great Recession of 2008, 2009. So I think there's a lot of evidence, both domestically and internationally, that unregulated economic systems like this are crapshoots, and crapshoots in this particular case that allow, money launderers of all kinds to operate. So I think there's going to be a lot of pushback. I think El Salvador is taking a huge risk. And I think eventually these kind of cryptocurrency systems are going to find themselves facing regulation. It will take a long time, just like there's a huge pushback on the part of people like Facebook and Google and, you know, all the tech companies. But it's probably eventually going to happen, and it will happen in El Salvador as well, although, you know, the country may face a big price between now and then.
Well, it's already facing a price with this dreadful leader, so combination of that and Bitcoin, it doesn't look good. But I thank you for joining us, Jeff Thale.
Sure, it's a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Thale, the former president of the Washington Office on Latin America, where he oversaw their work on Central America, focusing on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in the region, with a particular emphasis on Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Martin Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. Now that I have resigned from Pacifica, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Time one night.